Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We've got a great show for you today. Copyright has probably become one of the most important policy issues in the country, not just for media, not just for communication, but for the entire political system. Yet it's not very well understood, certainly its historical origins and its purpose. Today we're going to have the author of a brand new book which will help clarify those issues and hopefully give us a better sense of where we ought to be going. Lewis Hyde will be our guest today on Media Matters, but first let's go to Media Minute.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Public media is the most trusted source of news in both the United States and in Great Britain. And yet, public media institutions are fighting for their lives. Both PBS and NPR in the States and BBC across the pond are being challenged by economic and political pressures, a rapidly changing journalism landscape, and technological innovations that are transforming the way people view news. This week, leading figures in public media and journalism discussed the new challenges and innovations in public media at a panel sponsored by Free Press and the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. Mark Thompson, director of the BBC.
Public broadcasting is founded on a belief in public space. In other words, on the belief that there's room for a place which is neither part of the state nor purely governed by commercial considerations, in which everyone is free to enter and within which they can encounter culture, education, debate, where they can share and swap experiences.
But the idea of public space is being challenged, especially on the web, where commercial interests are trying to monetize the internet. Thompson says that public media can combat those forces because of its mission of inclusion and access.
In fact, it seems to me that digital media and its open, democratizing spirit represent an almost perfect fit with what I mean by the term public space, and that if the BBC and other public broadcasters can migrate safely and successfully into this new world, that far from slipping to the edge, to the peripheral vision of our audiences, our eye and ear contact with them can grow deeper and more valuable.
PBS President Paula Kerger said public media can excel in areas where commercial media has fallen down. News and information, cultural arts, and educational and children's programming. Collaboration with other organizations to partner together to make media that will serve the public and create new avenues for funding is necessary for success.
If we don't take the opportunity now to really try to build out some of those partnerships and think about some of the new ways that we can move forward and look at the new ways of bringing in funding, including government funding, we will have indeed lost a moment.
To watch the entire panel discussion on public media in a digital age, go to newpublicmedia.org.
In an age when consumers can mute and fast-forward commercial breaks, advertisers are looking for ways to sell products where people are least expecting it, embedded into local news broadcasts. The problem is, there is no way for viewers to tell the real news from the fake news. Last week, Free Press filed a letter asking the FCC to put an end to fake news. Fake news is a way to sneak paid advertising into a news broadcast by dressing it up as real news. It takes many different forms, from prepared stories called video news releases that are created by PR firms, to live interviews with so-called experts who are never identified on air as paid spokespeople for certain products or companies. Libby Reinisch, program coordinator with Free Press.
One particularly bad example is a local CBS affiliate that aired a segment entitled CBS Health Watch, in which the station's news reporters interviewed local hospital officials on cancer treatments. In fact, that news segment was part of a series of paid medical advertisements sponsored by the hospital in question.
The letter comes on the heels of an LA Times investigation that found fake news being aired without disclosure all over the country. Viewers are led to believe they're watching a genuine news segment, but are actually watching a hidden advertisement. The letter urges the FCC to investigate new instances of fake news, conclude its review of pending complaints, and put new rules on the books that would require stricter and more prominent disclosure of paid spots.
The evidence in that expose made it clear that instances of fake news are on the rise, And now is the time for the FCC to take action to enforce the rules it has and create stricter rules to protect consumers from fake news. Viewers deserve to know when someone's paying to persuade them.
Reinisch said that fake news is more prevalent now than ever thanks to media consolidation, which has gutted newsrooms. Crippled by job cuts, local stations no longer have the capacity to produce real news, but often turn to fake news to fill broadcast gaps. But fake news, said Reinisch, undermines the basic function of broadcasters to serve the public interest.
The news is a public service, not the commercial break before the commercial break. We depend on our news to uphold principles of independence, credibility, and accuracy in reporting. And fake news makes it impossible to trust our news sources. Our news shouldn't come from a PR firm.
For more information, visit savethenews.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, October 10, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest and author of a brand new book called Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. The author is Lewis Hyde, who is a professor at Kenyon College of Creative Writing and also is a faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He's written several other books, including Trickster Makes This World. Lewis Hyde, welcome to Media Matters.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, you begin the book, and the book periodically returns to a theme I think that all listeners to Media Matters and most Americans are familiar with, which is the ongoing campaign to equate copyright or property and culture and ideas with ownership and property in sort of physical goods. So owning a authorship of a book or a song is the same as owning a car or a hamburger.
Right.
And talk a little bit about that campaign and what that campaign, how that influenced your decision to write this book.
So, you know, the entertainment industry is rightly upset by what's happened since the internet and digital copying have appeared. And they have been aggressive in their campaign to get people to take seriously their ownership of their products. But part of what they do is to, I think, confuse the kind of things that they make with physical goods, as you say, like automobiles or shoes or physical books in a bookstore. And it's an important confusion not to wander into because property in art and ideas is distinct in kind from property in houses and automobiles, and the distinctions are important. The main thing economists always say when they talk about this is that you know, physical goods are what we call rivalrous. That is, if we have one apple between us and you take it, then I don't have it, and we can become rivals against it. Whereas ideas are not rivalrous. If you have an idea, you can tell it to me, and you haven't lost it. So right away, there's an important difference. And a second difference is a matter of excludability. So many people think that the core thing about a property right is that if you have a piece of property, you can exclude other people from it. And this, of course, is true. If I have a house, I can lock my door and keep people out, and that's partly how I know it's my house. But again, if you go to non-physical things like art and ideas, they often are non-excludable. If somebody has figured out the Pythagorean theorem and, you know, told it to the world, it's hard to keep people from knowing it and using it. So in a certain sense, then the other point of departure in my book is to say, gosh, historically and by nature, these things have been thought of as things that lie in the commons, that all of us and have access to them and use them. And so let's think about common culture, not private culture.
As I understand it, Lewis Hyde, also, I mean, there's real problems, in your view, with this notion of equating copyright, cultural production, ideas, research, with private goods, that there's a real cost for our society.
Well, I mean, put the other way, there's a real benefit to having things circulate freely among us. And You know, one thing I've done is to go back to the founders of this nation and think about how they understood the circulation of knowledge. And so one simple example is there's a benefit for democratic society to have ideas freely circulate and have very low barriers to the circulation of knowledge. And you also get lively, creative communities if people can communicate with each other easily. So in a certain sense, there are obvious benefits to treating cultural goods in common, and one needs to therefore make a clear argument about why you would take them out of the commons. And I think in some cases there are good arguments for doing that, but you need to think about the ends you're trying to serve if you're going to lock something up and make it private.
Lewis Hyde, there have been many books on copyright written over the past 10 or 15 years, many concerned with the very issues that we've been talking about already here. What is your take on it? What value added does your book bring to it? What do you do? What did you want to add to the discussion that wasn't there in your view?
Well, mostly, you're right. Many people have been doing very, very good work on this, and particularly around the Internet. The one thing I've done that others haven't done much is to, as I said, go back to the founding generation and to sort of the historical roots of these protocols. And actually, I go back even before to... you know, anciently, everybody thought that created things like a mythology or a poem or a song lay in the commons. So I explain that, and then also go back to the 17th century in England and to the 18th century in this country, and try to excavate the narratives by which our forefathers understood these questions. You know, for example, we have the phrase intellectual property. This is a very modern phrase. It really doesn't appear until the 20th century. There was no such thing in the 18th century. So you have to ask, you know, what were they thinking of and how were they thinking? And it's not that I'm an originalist. That is to say, if you find something that Thomas Jefferson or James Madison believed, I don't think that necessarily has any purchase on the present moment. But I ended up thinking that, in fact, much of what they have to say does usefully help us widen the ground for our discussion of these topics.
Our guest today in Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Lewis Hyde, author of the new book, Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership, just published this year. We are live today at WILL AM 580, so please call in for any questions or comments. The number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Hyde, in your book, you go through not just the history of copyright and commons and cultural work, but one of the things I found really interesting about the book was you demonstrated something I sort of knew, and I've read in other contexts, but your book really developed it in a different light for me, which is how our very notions of property itself, even independent of cultural work or what's called intellectual property, but our very notions of property have changed dramatically from over time, even in the revolutionary era, even in the 18th century in the United States, the sense of property and how much a person could possess and do with it was quite different than it would become under what we call today capitalism.
Yeah, well, I suppose I think there are two things that I got interested in this regard. One is to back off and ask the simple question, so what do we mean by property? And as I said earlier, often one simple definition is it's a thing where you have the right to exclude other people. But I got interested in a different definition, which is that property gives you rights of action, that you're allowed to do things with the things you own. You know, if you own a car, you can drive it or sell it or loan it or whatever. So there's a whole bundle of different actions you can take. And what I like about this is that it puts an emphasis on the agency that property gives us. It allows us to do things in the world. It makes us citizens, if that's the end we're trying to serve. So, for example, in the old agricultural commons in Europe, people had different rights to use the commons. You could go cut firewood, and that was called the right of estivers and so forth. You could go cut turf, and that was the right of turbary and so forth. So that's one piece. The other piece, which I think maybe is what you were leading to, is in the 18th century, people now, in retrospect, describe it as a time when people had an ideology of civic republicanism. So the founders were trying to set up a republic, a democratic self-governing nation, and many of them felt that the point of property was to give you a basis from which to become a public actor. That is, it wasn't just about self-aggrandizement and increasing your wealth for yourself and your family. It was the necessary precondition of going out and serving your community. And the value at that point was to acquire something called civic virtue, which would be the virtue that your fellow citizens accord you because you have done useful things for them. And a famous example is Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, you know, became rich, but he basically retired from his printing business and began to both do scientific investigations and serve his nation.
I thought of Franklin exactly with that question, because one of the most striking passages in the book is where you talk about Franklin's notion of superfluous property, which is, I would say, virtually alien to any notion of property in America today, except on the far left.
So Franklin differentiates between the things you actually need to live and stuff you have beyond that. And in a sort of civic republican mode, he says, you know, all property is a creature of society. Nobody's going to have their wealth unless they live in a society that helps them earn it and protects them, you know, protects them from thieves taking it away and so forth. And superfluous property is both a creature of society and then also is available if society needs something. So if you need, well, there's a famous example of this last week. If you need to build a tunnel between New Jersey and New York City to serve the citizens of New Jersey, then it's appropriate to raise some taxes to do it, not putting anybody in the poorhouse, but saying superfluous property can be put to other ends if the community agrees upon it.
Our guest, Lewis Hyde, author of Common as Air. The phone lines are open here at Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. And I guess, Professor Hyde, before we go much further, we ought to clarify what exactly we mean by copyright and its legal status in the U.S., how it got, you know, made into law here, so people know we're all on the same page, because I think sometimes I assume and people assume that everyone already knows the history of its legal status.
Yeah. Well, let me do it in two chapters and begin with the earliest copyright law, because it's a good, it's a simple model. So the year is 1710 in England, and the background is that the government, the crown in England, had controlled printing by giving monopoly privileges to printers. So there were always special printers. It's a good way to control the press and reduce sedition and heresy and so forth. And that begins to change in the 18th century, and they invent the first copyright law, which gives publishers and authors exclusive rights to their work for a limited term. And the term initially was 14 years, and you could double it if you were still alive. And there are two features of this that are of interest. One is a previous printing privileges were perpetual, as if some printer had the right to print the Bible. He had it for decades and decades. And that was really a suppression of the market, because other printers might want to do it. So putting a 28-year cap on this meant that things went into the public domain, and then other printers could enter. And that's what happened. Scottish printers, printers in the United States, were free to print things.
And then the price of the book plummets.
Yes, and you get a competitive market, and you get cheaper goods. And that's useful. One thing to say, I earlier said that you know, the crown would give monopoly privileges. In fact, copyright for the founders was itself thought of as a short-term monopoly privilege, not really a property right in the sense that we now use that term, but we the state decide to give people monopoly powers over their own expression for a limited term, but it's a privilege we give them for good reason, but it's not a natural property right. So just to round this out, copyright is a set of controls that we give to creators for a limited term. In this country, I mean, what's happened since 1710 is that the scope and duration and range of copyright has extended radically. And so now I, as a book author, own my work for my lifetime plus 70 years, so my heirs get the happy day that it continues to earn money, they get the money, and corporations get 95 years. And one thing to say about this is that these terms are so long that statistically they're almost indistinguishable from a perpetual term. And basically anything written in my lifetime will never come out of copyright during my lifetime. So it changes the feel of the field.
Well, you know, you just jumped from 1710 to 300 years in,
yes.
in one sentence, which was very impressive. Let's back up about 200 of those years or 220 of those years and go to the Constitution. And your book spends a good bit of time, not talking about the legal debates necessarily, but certainly the intellectual debates between Jefferson and Madison and Adams and their deliberations at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, their understanding of why copyright needed to be put in the U.S. Constitution and, you know, their vision of it and how that is so different from what you just described we have today.
You know, but the first thing to say actually is, yes, there is a clause in the Constitution that allows the Congress to give these privileges to people. And that passed at the convention. But in fact, there was a lot of debate. And early on, when the Constitution was being framed, Thomas Jefferson was in Paris. And so we have letters between Jefferson and Madison, and Jefferson is thinking about this emerging document. And one interesting thing is that he kept saying, you know, there has to be a Bill of Rights. We need a Bill of Rights. And he keeps listing them. And one of the things he always lists is that there have to be restrictions against monopolies. And what he means is copyright and patent. And now he drops this, but it's important to sort of see this as a marker at the edge of the debate. Again, Jefferson, Madison, Adams, all these people understood copyright as a monopoly privilege. They thought monopolies were dangerous, that they tended to have in the past been used as tools of despotism. And so on the one side, Jefferson actually thought we should forbid them entirely. Now he slowly changes his mind, and we do...
I've got to stop you there because what you just said is so important, Professor Hyde. I mean, I think I want people listening to this to pause for a second and consider the implications of the words you just uttered and that are in your book, which is that in Jefferson's mind, the most important thing that our Constitution protects is the individual right to have a public domain and not have copyright cover everything.
Yes, and in the background lies the problem of the thing they were trying to do was create a self-governing nation. And so for them... free debate was the primary goal. You know, in a way, my book is partly trying to reframe some of how we think about this. And the entertainment industry has a very plausible frame, which is that it's about private property and ownership. But that would have surprised the founders. So in this case, the frame with which they approached the question of copyright was freedom of speech and political and religious debate.
Our guest, Lewis Hyde, the phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Lewis Hyde, the author of the book we've been talking about, Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership, just published. Lewis Hyde is a professor both at Kenyon College in Ohio and at Harvard's Berkman Center. Let's go to the phone lines right now for our first caller, Line 1, Peoria. You're on the air.
Hello, my name is Roy Beckham, and I'm a citizen of Peoria, Illinois. And I just want to tell you guys that we respect what you're doing, and we really embrace the information, the topic that you're discussing today. I want to take this time to tell Mr. Bob McChesney that I was a student at the University of Illinois, and also his guest as well. I was a student at University of Illinois in 2009, and I took his class, Money, Media, and Power. We discussed the political economy of the media. And I want to invite you guys down to Peoria, Illinois, to discuss on my radio show, The New Movement, a community radio show based in Peoria, Illinois, to talk about some of the things that you're talking about today. And I hope that you guys play this because I want everybody to know the type of people that we're trying to bring to Peoria, to our community radio station, and the type of topics and information that we're putting out there to the citizens.
Well, why don't you get a hold of me off air, and we can take this private, but I'd be glad to be in your program, and thank you for listening to the show, and I'm glad you took my class. All right, well, thank you very much. I don't think that was even a true-false question, Professor Hyde. I think that was just simply a nice comment from a listener in nearby Peoria. And, you know, I think notion of copyright to the restriction of it, going into the history a little bit more of the founding period. As you point out in the book, it's initially, I think, 14 terms. People had to apply for it, so most books weren't even covered unless there was a proactive step taken. And books written by Charles Dickens or someone from any other country were not eligible for copyright protection at all in this country for the first, 100 years, 100 and some years of American history.
Yes, this is an amusing point. I mean, the first time that this country wrote a copyright law was 1790. And it includes what I think of as the piracy clause, which is to say our first copyright law said directly, none of this applies to anything that's printed outside of the country. And that meant that all other foreign authors, like Charles Dickens, were not protected here. And on the positive side, what it meant was that the United States had very cheap books for sale for 100 years. Said in generally, what you tend to see is that countries which are net importers of intellectual property are happy to have very low rules about how to protect it, and countries that are net exporters want to have very high rules.
Mm-hmm.
So we've become a net exporter, and we are busily trying to bully the rest of the world into obeying the laws that we like. But the fact is that for 100 years, we were on the other side of this debate, and we're gladly not obeying the laws the English wanted. So,
you know, the point of copyright, as you pointed out at the beginning, as I understood, have always understood it, and your book, I think, made clear, was it was understood you needed this limited monopoly for a brief period so that the author would be able to make a living and they'd have incentive to keep writing books. And it was in the public interest to allow this monopoly because then we'd have a much greater wealth of knowledge created that would all eventually be in the public domain. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, and it can be expanded usefully in one way, which
okay.
is to say, again, in the 18th century, the experience had been that cultural production mostly came out of patronage, and that involved the aristocrats in Europe or the church in Europe. And so there was an interest in creating another base, which is a commercial base. That is to say, if you could begin to have a market in books, you could begin to have publishing houses and newspapers, which are absolutely independent of the state and the church, and also authors and scholars and stuff who are absolutely independent. And then you can begin to have public debate, which is less bullied by the patrons who previously had to be the supporters of it. So mm-hmm. this is one of the good reasons to have a short-term monopoly privilege. Yeah.
Well, I just want to follow up on I think you make that point in the book, and I think it makes a lot of sense, and I think that's a valuable argument on behalf of copyright. The point I want to get at is when you were, because it gets back to something you talked about earlier, which is, you know, Jefferson actually, as you point out in the book, studied actuarial tables to figure out what the length of a patent should be.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fascinating. And, you know, the idea was, though, there was a strict limit on how much time copyright or patent would be, the monopoly would be eligible, and then it would go right to the public domain. And, you know, but the principle was it should be a long enough time to make sure the commercial success was in place, but no longer, not one day longer.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how today, you know, you have, for this book, Common as Air, a personal copyright of your entire lifetime plus an additional 70 years. Which, you know, obviously makes a mockery of that notion. If someone had told you, Lewis Hyde, well, Lewis Hyde, I have bad news for you, before you started writing this book 3 or 4 years ago, said, we're reducing your copyright of this book to your lifetime in 65 years. You know, you wouldn't have said, well, then I'm not writing this book. That term isn't good enough for me to write a book. What is the rationale for the extension from the original plan that still is something that's not quite clear to me? Does that make sense to you?
Yes. I don't think there is a good rationale. I think the rationale is to change the frame that we're no longer talking about the public good. We're talking about private wealth, and it tends to be large corporations which have wealth in ideas and would like to secure it and carry it forward. Again, I'm not opposed to authors receiving their royalties. I think that's a very good thing, but it does become a little bit nuts. When the copyright term was extended 10 or 15 years ago by the Congress, the law went all the way to the Supreme Court, and a bunch of economists wrote to the Supreme Court, including Nobel Prize winners on the left and on the right, who said the same thing you're saying, which is the incentive argument doesn't make any sense. once you get up to a certain number of years, that you're adding no incentive at all. What you're really doing, though, is giving corporations a greater power over expression, which is part of how we think our democracy ought to work, that expression ought to be free.
It's also, is it not, Lewis Hyde, really a subsidy made by the public with this artificial monopoly right extended by public fiat for a greater length of time, because it raises prices, therefore, and increases profits for the copyright holders, whoever they might be.
Yep.
So in a way, it's an indirect subsidy created by the government for these fortunate people who are copyright holders. That's not an entirely inaccurate way to put it, is it?
No. In fact, we've been talking about the fact that these things are monopoly privileges, and I was speaking of monopoly initially in terms of suppressing expression, but monopoly also is a problem in economics because it has a thing economists call dead weight loss. But basically, it means everything costs more if it's caught up in a monopoly system, and so one again ought to be very cautious of granting state sanctioned monopolies.
Our guest today, you've just been listening to, is Lewis Hyde, professor at Kenyon College of Creative Writing, also connected to Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Lewis Hyde is the author of today's book, Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. He's also the author of several other books, including Trickster Makes the World. The phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open if people wish to call. And in the book, and I want our listeners to be well aware of this, there's a rich history. I think it's the lion's share of the book. It's the original contribution of the book. A rich history of the development of the notion of the commons, of property, and of the 18th century debates and thinking on ideas of ownership of ideas that took place, especially among Benjamin Franklin first and foremost, but also Madison and Jefferson. And I want to spend the balance of the show allowing you, Professor Hyde, to discuss some of that. And let's start with a theme that you touch on in the book, which is, the argument today on behalf of intellectual property, the argument that copyright holders and their trade associations, the industries make, and now the U.S. government makes as it pushes for U.S.-style intellectual property rules all over the world as part of its trade deals. The argument is that only an intellectual property regime can successfully work in the modern economy and generate the sort of pharmaceutical breakthroughs, technological breakthroughs, creative ideas, on and on, that a good society needs. And the converse to that is the idea of the commons can't work, that there's no incentive in a common system for people to produce. The article that's routinely cited and that you refer to in the book is the article from some 40 years ago called The Tragedy of the Commons. Could you just talk about what that article was about and your critique of it, why you don't think it necessarily applies to the situation of copyright today?
Sure. So this was a man named Garrett Hardin who was writing an essay actually about population. And he had a kind of fantasy about agricultural commons, imagining, say, a sheep meadow and a bunch of sheep farmers. And he said, once the sheep farmers have access to this meadow, nothing will stop them from just putting more and more sheep on it. And a meadow may have a thing called carrying capacity, which is to say only so many sheep can be grazing on the grass before the thing begins to turn into a big mud field. and therefore, his thesis was common ownership is inherently tragic. It will fall apart because rational herdsmen will constantly add more sheep. So the point about carrying capacity actually is a useful contribution, that this is a problem with embodied commons, like fisheries off the coast of New England, not a problem with abstract commons, like art and ideas. But more the point in terms of history, Garrett Hardin was actually wrong about how commons worked in Europe, and people have written a lot about this in response to the tragedy article, and basically pointed out that agricultural commons were highly governed by custom, and everybody in the village knew that there were limits on what you could do. Typically, for example, you could only put as many sheep on the common fields as you could keep in your barn in winter, or you could only cut wood in the forest during certain months. There were all kinds of restraints called stints. The use of the commons was stinted, was constrained, and that meant that commons in agricultural commons lasted for millennia in Europe. So maybe one last point is the rule that I'm most fond of is there was a custom called beating the bounds. And every year, villagers would gather together and have a kind of party in which cakes and beer would be served, and people would have axes and mattocks and shovels and spades and would walk the boundaries of their commons. And if anybody had encroached upon the commons or tried to take it away, they would tear down the encroachments. And so it's one of the many ways commons were protected, and I would love to see us bring forward a kind of habit of beating the bounds of the things we think we own in common.
You know, I do want to talk about Ben Franklin in a second, but let's just jump forward to the 20th century now, if we can, Professor Hyde. You go with, later in the book, through a few classic examples of how copyright has been, in your view, I think it's safe to say, abused or distorted out of what it should be doing, and has really gotten in the way of a healthy society. And maybe these examples, I think, will help clarify the issues for listeners who might find our discussion so far abstract. Starting with Dr. Martin Luther King's estate and his I Have a Dream speech, which I found I sort of knew about this from afar, but I wasn't entirely familiar with it. What's the story there?
Well, so after Martin Luther King was assassinated, his family owns the rights to his works, and they have essentially they've commercialized the work so that people, scholars and people who want to use King's work in the civic and spiritual way that he might have intended it, have been frustrated. A simple example is that USA Today at one point printed, on Martin Luther King Day, printed the I Have a Dream speech, and the estate went after them for copyright infringement. What they have done, you'd think sometimes people controlling an estate are trying to protect the dignity of the original author, but the converse is the case in this instance, it seems, because the King estate has authorized many advertising agencies to use King's image and words in ads. One of them was for Singular Wireless, and they have Kermit the Frog singing, you know, he has a dream, and the point being that rate plans have become a ghetto. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's it's a conversion of a public voice which had political and spiritual ends in mind into a commercial voice where the ends are entirely about making money.
I mean, it also strikes me, and this not just in the case of King, but this would apply to the great-grandchildren of Charles Dickens or anyone else who might apply to Stephen King, any rock star, that, I mean, the idea of copyright wasn't necessarily to mean that the great-great-great-grandchildren of some copyright, of some creative content creator, writer, artist, would never have to work a day in their lives. I mean, what's that all about?
Well, you're right. It doesn't make sense. I mean, the other example in the book is the what's happened to the James Joyce estate. His grandson seems to have a chip on his shoulder about his grandpa and has used his powers in controlling the works of James Joyce to suppress scholarship and debate. Let me actually mention one example of this kind of problem that came up more recently. I don't know if you knew, but in the state of Missouri, there's a Senate race between Robin Carnahan Roy Blunt, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And the Carnahan people used 30 seconds of a Fox News interview with Roy Blunt in one of their ads. And Fox News has gone after them with a copyright infringement complaint, saying, well, we own this 30 seconds and you can't use it. And it's a classic example of the use of the monopoly privilege to suppress speech. And, at the end of the day, if this goes through the court, I'm almost certain that it'll be thrown out because, in fact, we have a thing called fair use where people are allowed to use 30 seconds or more of somebody else's speech in a political campaign. But the fact is we only got 3 or 4 weeks left in this campaign, and so it turns out you can use the exclusive privileges that copyright gives you to affect political debate. And this would have astounded the founders. It is exactly opposite their sense of why we might give these rights, and it's exactly why Jefferson was worried about them.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest again is Lewis Hyde, author of the new book, Common as Air. Let's go to our caller on line 4, Ottawa, Illinois. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good, thank you.
Anyway, I was wondering if your guest could comment on the new copyright law, how it would affect BitTorrent sites. That's, you know, these sites regularly post copyright material on they're downloaded by, you know, a lot of people. I just wonder how he felt about these sites and how it will affect them. I'll take my answer off here.
Well, thank you very much. We had a sort of a fuzzy connection there, Lewis. Hi, were you able to hear the question?
Yeah, well, the question is about BitTorrent sites, which allow people to download huge amounts of data. And the worry, of course, is that people are going to download not just audio files now, but proprietary films and so forth. I mean, my short answer is I have no interest in supporting the piracy of appropriately owned intellectual property. And but you have to back off and complicate the question in a way. I mean, the Internet is so new and so remarkable that we are inventing the rules of the road as we go. And it's not clear. You know, part of the point of my book is to say, okay, as we do this, we have to now rethink a lot of the rules that we've come up with. We should go back and think about why we have these rules. And, well, a simple example, you know, I've mentioned democratic self-governance is one of the concerns of the founders. Another concern was scientific community. And Franklin is an example of somebody who was a member of such a community and thought that conversation ought to be free. But to jump this to the question about BitTorrent, you know, scientists today exchange huge amounts of data over the Internet, and they need Internet connectivity that can allow them to do this. And so there you have a different kind of question about what you should or shouldn't be able to do. And the problem often is that one sort of set of rules that work very well for the media industry come in and begin to govern other domains, such as the scientific community or the academy, and work at cross purposes. So the end of the question is, you got to think what the ends are that you're trying to reach.
Yeah, and I guess the question on the Internet, and I wanted to get this later, but this is an appropriate time to raise it, is, you know, we had Jared Lanier on that program about 6 or 7 months ago. He's one of the founders or creators of virtual reality. And he's also a musician. And he said, you know, let's be honest, what the Internet is right now is it's creative people are the new peasants of the digital era. There's simply no way we can support ourselves on this. And I don't think he was a big fan of extended aggressive or onerous copyright laws. He was genuinely said it's just not going to happen. But I think, clearly the founders want it to happen, and they think that we have to somehow have people be able to support themselves to do creative work. What is the way out without these super onerous copyright rules? How can we support people who are journalists, support people who are musicians, filmmakers, artists in a digital world?
Yeah, you know, I do not know the answer to this question, and it's a serious question. I mean, one answer has been in some of the music industry to it used to be that you put the band on tour to sell records. Now maybe you sell records or let people download music for free in order to get audiences at the band for concerts, the kind of Grateful Dead model in which the actual monopoly they have is their presence on the stage. But it's a serious question that needs to be, whose answer we don't yet know. I should say that, the fantasy that writers like myself can be independent based on their royalties is a fantasy. I mean, I know hundreds of writers. I know none of them, with one exception, who can make a living as a writer. Almost all of us have other jobs. So, some sort of mixed economy of doing two things at once, doing the thing you love and figuring out how some way to support it, and maybe some democratic patronage and some, you know, government laws that help fertilize the field. You know, we have to make this up.
our guest, Lewis Hyde. Let's go back to the phone lines now to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 1, Peoria, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. I have two questions, very quick. Didn't Mark Twain believe that his writings were like an estate, that he was building an estate for his children? And the other thing, I just read that some politicians, including Sarah Palin, actually hire people to do their Twittering for them. And in that case, does the Twitter belong to the author or to the twit?
Okay, well, thank you very much, caller. Lewis Hyde?
Yes, Twain is a good example. What's happened since 1790 when we first wrote a copyright law is every 20 or 50 years, the law gets revisited, partly because the technology changes. And so in, I think, 1906, we were revising our copyright law, and Twain got much involved in that, and he wanted the term extended. What he actually said at the end of the day, I think what they did in that day was to give a 28-year ownership, which, again, could be renewed if you asked for it. And Twain finally said, okay, this will allow my children some independence, and the grandchildren will have to take care of themselves. So, you know, that was Twain's compromise. As for people who pay people to Twitter, one useful distinction to remember is that there's a thing called work for hire. And so if you're a cartoonist who works for the Walt Disney Company, they pay you a salary, and whatever you make does not belong to you. It belongs to the person who pays your salary. So if I hire somebody to write my Twitter postings, they belong to me and not to the person I've hired, who is a contractual employee and gets no rights going forward.
And that leads to something else, which I think is very confusing for a lot of folks, and certainly would have astounded the founders and Jefferson and Madison, which is that copyrights can be traded on a market, so that someone could own the copyrights to creative work they just purchased from someone else. They had no connection to actually producing them themselves.
Well, in a sense, what happens is copyrights can be licensed. I mean, I license my work to my publisher under certain terms. There is an American copyright law, a thing that after some number of years, like 35, it reverts to me no matter what license I signed. But it's certainly true in the corporate world that, yes, you can make a movie and take out a copyright on it, and then you can sell it to somebody else. So it is a tradable property.
And this is where I want to get one of those interesting discussions in the book. And in one of my classes, we talked about this endlessly, which is Bob Dylan, the well-known artist and musician. His, I think, first five or six albums, until he got to the electric phase in, say, 1965 or so, I think, except for the very first one, which is fairly obscure, but the second through the fourth or fifth album, are some of the best-known folk albums ever recorded and some of the most famous songs, very classics of Americana at this point. And I sort of knew this. When I read your book, it reminded me that the melodies of virtually all those great songs are lifted pretty much directly from the great folk songbook of America,
Yeah. The
great tradition, you know, these beautiful melodies, frankly. And it was an arresting discussion in a lot of different ways. Just talk a little bit about that.
Yes, there's a wonderful book has been done by a guy at the Library of Congress called The Formative Dylan. And what he did was to take the first 70 songs that Dylan ever recorded and traced their roots in the African-American and Anglo-American folk tradition. And almost all of them have clear songs, particularly in terms of melody. Melody is not, Dylan himself says he's not a melodist. He typically begins with somebody else's melody and plays with it. And so, you know, it raises wonderful questions about how much of this you can own. It's, again, I think one of the reasons we limit the ownership of cultural goods, because cultural goods are always made out of things that have come before. And so to take them private, you know, may be a privilege that we allow people for good reason, but it also is a diminishment of what was previously common. So,
well, to me, to take it where I went with that, Professor Hyde, among other things, was that, you know, why was Bob Dylan the one who's allowed to sort of say, okay, this far but no further, I can do it, but now if anyone after this wants to come and take my songs and do what I did to those songs, they can't. it seems like, you know, if we're going to be honest to the principle of intellectual property, we ought to back it up to the people that Dylan took it from.
Well, I suppose anybody could go back to the root songs that Dylan used and use them again. He doesn't own the root.
Mm-hmm.
But and it is true that in American law, if you do something transformative to his work, if you change it significantly, or, for example, if you write parodies, you can do it. But it's true that we begin to get into a murky area where things which we thought were common turn out to be owned.
You know, I suspect if someone did to Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind what Bob Dylan did to Robert Johnson's song that led to something like Blowing in the Wind, a battery of lawyers would visit you that didn't visit Bob Dylan.
That seems to be the trend, yes.
And then one other thing on this while we're at it, Professor Hyde, would be this whole notion of the genome sequencing and how intellectual property, you know, what some of the ethical, moral, political, social issues here that are very profound and decisions that are made now are going to affect us in ways we might not fully anticipate. I thought it was one of the most troubling aspects of your book, frankly.
So this really is more about the kind of ownership called patent, where you get to have a smart idea like bifocal lenses, which Benjamin Franklin invented, and you get to own the idea. One of the old rules in patent law was that you can't own a fact of nature. So if you figure out that the speed of light or something, you can't take a patent on that. You can be famous for figuring it out, but you don't get to own it. And one of the troubling things that's happened in the last 50 years is that we've begun to give people patent rights over parts of the human genome, which are naturally occurring things. And then what people, once we've done that, people begin to stake claims in genetic knowledge without even knowing what purposes the pieces of the genome serve that they have patented. It's kind of prospecting. It's like going out into the field and sticking down a lot of stakes, hoping there's gold someplace. And so, you know, that alone is troubling. What I do in the book is a comparison between the part of the Human Genome Project where they mapped the human genome that was done with public money and philanthropic money versus a private enterprise that also was doing the same thing. And the burden of the story really is that a scientific problem as complicated and mysterious as mapping the entire human genome actually works best if it's undertaken in a common property regime instead of in a private property regime. I'll give you one quick example of something that happened after this book came out.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out some years ago, people trying to figure out what are called biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease got together and said, you know, it's very hard to work if the academy and the government and the private companies are all being very protective of their data. The only way we can do this is we share data and everybody's on the same page every morning. Anytime you discover something, you make it public. And so they did this, and consequently there has been a great increase in knowledge about biomarkers for Alzheimer's. It's, again, a simple case of a kind of complex science which is best conducted in a common property regime, not a private property one.
Our guest today, Lewis Hyde, you've just been listening to, a professor of creative writing at Kenyon College, also a faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet Society, the author of numerous books, including the brand new book, Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. We've been talking about it for the past 50 minutes or so. And we've only got a few minutes left, but Professor Hyde, I do want to talk about people who read your book or who listen to this program, who are even just care about the issue and are concerned about it. Copyright is a public policy issue. It's in the Constitution, and then the laws have been passed by Congress. It is you know, something that has been created by governments and by legislative bodies. What can we do if we want to have a better system of copyright, or one that returns to the founding principles, one that expands, protects, preserves the notion of the public domain?
Well, first of all, do we
have champions in Congress, for example?
No.
Is there legislation that we should be, looking at and pursuing and pushing and advocating and trying to get members of Congress to think about?
My book is not a policy book. It's not a book that ends up with a list. Though in the paperback, maybe I'll make a list. There are many things to do. I mean, one is, first of all, to, in the unhappy event that that they try to extend the term of copyright again, there needs to be a much better organized resistance to it. We should make sure that the Congress...
Well, let me stop you right there, because that point, I think, it's one that's really quite significant, because it, you have the term in your book that copyright now lasts forever minus a day, which refers to the fact that every time they've been extending the length of copyright for the last 50, 60 years, so that nothing new is formally going into the public domain for now almost 80 or 90 years.
Yeah.
And every time it looks like Mickey Mouse and things that were created in the 1920s were eligible to go into copyright, they extend it automatically another 10 or 15 years. And so it seems like it's almost, we basically have permanent copyright on the installment plan, which goes against the Constitution, just to put that in context.
That's my view, yes.
Well, I mean, it's written in the Constitution that it can't be permanent, so that's not even an interpretive
yes.
statement.
Well, it turns out if you're a smart lawyer, you can interpret that many different ways. But let me say one other question that comes up regularly is the degree to which norms that work very well for the entertainment industry get exported by law into other venues. So we should be cautious about laws which force the Academy to operate on terms that make most sense to the entertainment industry. And we should be cautious also about exporting American intellectual property laws to the rest of the world, where the issues are always different and have different complexities.
And then how has the response been to the book so far, Professor Hind?
You know, authors never know. You know, and 6 months later you get a royalty statement. But I mean, basically it's been well reviewed. I've been happy. I don't think I've had any negative reviews. People have said very nice things about it. It's selling fairly well. You know, my hope is that the book helps us have a better conversation. And so I guess we'll now see whether it begins to be part of the conversation that all of us have to have about how to own art and ideas.
Are there loose ends in the book that you'd like to pursue in the future, you'd like to see other people pursue, or is this pretty much tied up the issue for you?
Well, I'm pretty much done with the issue, except I do think that I may write an afterword when we do the paperback, which would be more about some of the policy questions. Given the philosophical background this book sketches, what should we now do? And particularly, I'm interested in what's called fair use. This is part of copyright law that allows us to use other people's material without asking permission or paying a fee. And I think we could do a lot more with fair use in this country, getting people to understand what rights they have, particularly in education. Most people in teaching don't know what their rights are, and we could give them a lot more agency in the classroom if they knew more about fair use.
Well, Professor Hind, I'm going to hear the band tuning up in the background, so I have to clear out of the studio. I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your Sunday to join us here at Media Matters.
Well, thank you for paying such close attention to this book.
And Lewis Hyde, the author of Common as Air, is guest today. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in a week. We'll have a recorded show of my lecture on my own book with John Nichols on the death and life of American journalism. 2 weeks from today, John Nichols will be the guest. We'll have our Pledge Drive extravaganza. Please join us. I want to thank Kyle Krohoff for being the engineer, Melissa, as always, for being my wonderful producer. See you all in next week. Take care.